Okay, I've got 10:30. Thanks everyone for coming. Hopefully some of you got a good spring break travel or resting. This is the MPO JC Transportation Technical Advisory Committee, Tuesday, March 24th. We're here in Emma Harvatt Hall in Iowa City. I'll go ahead and call the meeting to order and recognize any alternates that are here today. And I'm not seeing any. If so, speak up. Okay. Seeing none, looking for a motion to consider approval of the meeting minutes from January 20th.
Motion
is our second. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you. Moving on to agenda item number two, public discussion of any item not on the agenda. I've got just a couple quick things. I don't see Matt here, but you'll probably remember last meeting, we designated Matt Berkey from the Bike Iowa City to be the new liaison here at this meeting. I thought Matt would be here, but I'm not seeing him yet.
He's at Bike Summit
in DC. Oh, okay. Thank you, sir. The next thing I wanted to mention is at 11 o'clock, there will be a severe weather drill that I did not know about until a few days back. So we will ignore it, but they'll come on and they'll tell us there's a severe weather drill. We would normally obviously go downstairs, but we'll ignore that. So that'll happen at 11 o'clock. And then the last thing is Tom Martinez with Greater Iowa City's here and just wanted to introduce himself quickly.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Martinez. I'm a program manager with Greater Iowa City covering community and workforce developments and happy to sit in on the meeting.
Thanks, Tom. Anything else from the public or anything else the committee would like to discuss that's not on the agenda? Okay. Seeing none, moving on to agenda item number three, which is a presentation on the Safe Streets and Roads for All SS4A Safety Action Plan. We've got Mindy Moore here with HDR on the screen, and Mindy can further introduce herself and lead us through our presentation for the day. Morning, Mindy.
Great, thank you. I'm gonna share my screen here. Okay, are you seeing the screen now?
Yep, we are.
Great. As Ken said, we're presenting on the Safe Streets and Roads for All Safety Action Plan. This is the second meeting that we're having with all of you. We will have one more after this. But the last time we met with you was way back in November, so we wanted to give you an update of what we've been working on since then. So I will summarize the public involvement that we've gone through since that time. Bryce is here with me today. He's going to work on or describe the safety analysis that we've done, and then I will jump back in for the equity considerations and just the start of our strategies and then sum up with our schedule. So you all know Kent and Sarah. We've been working closely with them throughout this process. They started last summer. And then I'm the project manager on behalf of HDR, and Bryce is one of our traffic engineers and is a data analyst for this project. So what is the SS4A Safety Action Plan? This is just kind of a reminder. We did present this last time as well, but these are the 8 required elements of a safety action plan. This is funded through the Safe Streets and Roads for All program, which is federal funding. We have leadership commitment and goal setting. So that is each of the communities or the MPO in general will be asked to adopt a target date to achieve zero deaths and serious injuries due to traffic, by a certain date. And then that is kind of the overall goal setting. The planning structure is a series of meetings and committees that we are going through to create this plan. We do have a safety committee, which some of you are also serving on, so some of this may seem a little bit like a repeat from that. But some of you are not on that, so that's why we want to present this as well. And then we have the pink section, which is all of the analysis and all of the nitty-gritty work here. So that's what we are really just wrapping up around this time, safety analysis, engagement and collaboration, and equity considerations. And we're starting to move into that green section where we start to look at the strategies through policies, process, projects to achieve that zero deaths and serious injuries. And then in the gray box there is progress and transparency. That is, just being transparent about our process as we go through this, but also after the plan is adopted, the communities and the MPO continue to show their progress over time, show the improvement in the reduction of deaths and serious injuries due to traffic crashes, and show how projects are linked to that. So first, a little summary of public involvement. So in the fall, we did have three sort of pop-up booths that we attended. We were at the Iowa City's Farmers Market. There were about 55 people there that stopped by the booth. And a lot of their concerns focused on issues within Iowa City, particularly around biking and walking safety. We attended Africa Fest. We talked to about 19 or so people there. Their responses were more split between Iowa City and some of the surrounding communities, and were also a little more focused on driving than biking and walking. And then we also attended the Healthy Aging Fair. Here we got to talk to more older residents, as that target audience intended. We talked to about 43 or so people. They were focused more on areas outside of Iowa City and more concerned with driving issues and accessibility issues. We did an online survey as well that had some questions, as well as the ability to put a comment, you know, pick a point on the map of the region and comment on that. We had 184 people that responded to that survey and pointed out 340 locations. So a lot of these comments were related to speeding, particularly in school zones. A lot of issues related to driving at intersections, whether or not people were making complete stops or slowing down to look for oncoming people walking or biking. Biking and walking safety, particularly on busy roads, and this the e-scooter craze, so an issue with e-scooters and their ability to go pretty fast, and whether or not they're visible. And then the survey overall, as you can see here, some of the most commonly cited things were inadequate crosswalks, distracted driving, poor visibility, particularly at intersections, and then lack of facilities in general. So like the lack of the bikeway, the lack of a sidewalk, the lack of separation, inadequate shoulders. So things where we just, people are pointing out the need for better infrastructure in general. And then as you can see by the pie chart there, when people put their comment, they could say, is this about an intersection or about along a road? So about half of those were about an intersection, about 40% along the road, and then some people left that question blank. So also early this year in January, we had a focus group just to talk about equity concerns as it relates to transportation safety. We had the bike library was in attendance, the neighborhood centers of Johnson County, Dream City, Shelter House, Iowa City Human Rights, Johnson County, and North Liberty and Community Crisis Services were all part of this focus group session. A lot of discussion, again, around safety for people walking and biking, particularly for people that don't have the option of driving. They also pointed out the need for better transit and that, you know, people don't really care that they're leaving one city and entering another city. They just need to be able to get from one place to another and have that transit connect in an efficient way. They pointed out the need to also separate different types of users so that the people walking, biking, and on scooters are separated from motorists and feel safer that way. Safety at night. So a lot of the populations are moving around in the nighttime, and so those darker conditions make visibility more difficult. And then also some issues related to translation for limited English proficiency populations and better visibility at intersections. And you'll see this sort of intersection theme come up in a lot of what we talk about. And I'm going to go ahead and pass to Bryce, and he's going to go through the safety analysis.
Hello. Can you guys hear me okay? We've been having internet issues the last couple of days. So. All right. So if something changes, let me know. So right here, this first slide is the crash summary we've compiled. We looked at data from 2020 to 2024, and we excluded the freeways through the study area. So you can see we have some counts on the total number of fatalities that occurred, total number of serious injuries, and then we have crashes that involved impairments, pedestrians, cyclists, and young drivers. So that's an overview there. We can go ahead and go to the next slide. So our work got us to a high injury network. So high injury network is based off of severe crash history. And when we say that, we mean fatal crashes and serious injury crashes. And so it's a concentration of those tied to the segment. For this project, we included minor injury crashes as well, just because the number of fatal and serious injury crashes was not high enough to create a reliable network. And we did weight those a little bit less so that you didn't skew the network towards lower injury crashes. We want to keep it focused on fatal and serious injury crashes. And so every crash was tied to a roadway segment, whether it was an intersection or a segment crash. So the high injury network is just segment based. And basically, this is the density of serious injury crashes. And we picked, you know, the top 15% of the roadway network and this top 15% of the roadway network length includes 76% of fatal, serious, and minor injury crashes throughout the network, and then 77% of the fatal and serious injury crashes throughout the network. So this high injury network is meant to be reactive in that where's our hot spots of these severe crashes and where can we focus our efforts? And so getting you a network of 15% creates an actionable area you can focus on that will optimize your return on investment and the reduction in fatal and serious injury crashes. One note there is that when you look at the VRU crashes, we're covering actually 93% of the fatal, serious, and minor injury, and then almost 90% of the fatal and serious injury crashes as well.
And I don't think we said what VRUs are. That is vulnerable road user, and that is just people that are not in a vehicle, so anyone biking, walking, using a scooter, mobility device, that sort of thing.
Okay, so now we're shifting gears to a risk factor or risk network. And so this is different than the high injury network. So that high injury network is very reactive in that you're looking at your fatal and serious injury crashes, where those happened, and you're targeting those locations. For the risk factors, we want to try and create a more proactive approach in that, hey, where are we potentially going to see, fatal and serious injury crashes in the future? You know, what characteristics in our network, you know, are having us see those fatal and serious injury crashes? And so we looked at segment-based, and then we looked at several intersection types for risk factors. And so a risk factor is determined by being an overrepresentation of fatal and serious crashes compared to total crashes. So an example here on the segment risk factor, if you see that third bullet point, it says no median. So segments that have no median, when you looked at just fatal and serious injury crashes, that had a higher representation when you compared that to all severity crashes. And so that's, in a nutshell, how we determine what a risk factor is. One thing to note is that risk factors can be correlated to an underlying cause. And so no median, you know, does not mean go take out your medians. It means that this is a key characteristic that we had in the roadway network data that was tied to fatal and serious injury crash overrepresentation. And so this data here was all provided from the RAMS and then the Iowa PCR data. We did not collect any additional information, which if you collect more, you can be more specific in the underlying causes you want to target for a risk factor. So here for the segment risk factors, we have several. We've got a range of AADTs. We've got a roadway classification, shoulder type, speeds, and parking. And so you see on the map here, we've got, it says two risk factors, three risk factors, four, five, and six risk factors. So basically each segment we looked at and said, does it meet the criteria for a risk factor? And so that red means it met five or six risk factors there on the right. The green means it met three. And it doesn't matter which risk factors it met, just that it met, you know, three or four or five or six to try and show where we're seeing a lot of overlapping characteristics. So one thing to note as well is this low speed there is a good example of underlying characteristics. So you would not expect lower than 25 mile an hour segments to be a risk factor. But we found that this correlated a lot with locations that had those vulnerable road user or the non-motorist crashes. And so this is a great example of don't raise the speed limit because this says so, you know, understand that, hey, this is really targeting non-motorist areas, and that's what we're gleaming from that. So the first intersection type we looked at is the signalized intersections. So you can see undivided, we have three legs, and then we have low and high speed. And so again, low speed is an underlying characteristic for non-motorist crashes or potentially other characteristics in the network. Not necessarily that low speed means that's why it's a risky network. And then the volume cross product, that is the ADTs multiplied from the two legs. So your major leg multiplied by your minor leg. So if you take the square root, that gives you an idea of what your AADT ranges are. So now the next one we looked at is the minor road stop control intersections. We did not look at other types such as yield because there was such a low number of those intersection types that we would not be able to get a reliable analysis from those. So again, here's the same type of figure showing the risk factors and the count of risk factors at each intersection. We wanted to look at how the high injury network compared to the public comments. So we looked at a 500 foot buffer, and I don't know if you were able to check the survey, but people had to put points on the map. And from what I gathered, getting very specific locations was somewhat difficult if you weren't able to zoom in. So we had a wide buffer, but there still may be some that some points from the public that weren't quite as accurate as they had hoped for. But nonetheless, our high injury network covers 65% of public engagement comments. And remember, we had about 75 to 80% of fatal and severe crashes that covered the high injury network. So this is pretty good overlap from what the public's saying and from what we're seeing with fatal and serious crashes. We wanted to do the same thing for the risk network. So again, we used a 500 foot buffer. As you can see, the overlap, which is 57% of public comments on our highest risk networks, is lower than the high injury network. And that's to be expected because our risk factor network includes locations based on characteristics, not crash history. And so you're going to have locations that are listed as high risk that have not seen a crash history yet. So this falls in line with what we would expect to see. We did the same thing for intersections. We did both the signalized and the minor road stop control and wanted to compare the overlap. As you can see, 20% overlap on intersections. Again, this is difficult for the public to pinpoint a very exact location, but between that segment and intersection risk network, we had pretty good overlap of public engagement.
Okay, now I'm going to jump back in here and talk about our need to create a high priority network. So essentially, we do all this analysis that Bryce has just explained, and then you say, okay, well, so what? What do we do with this information? Well, we need to figure out a way to prioritize the segments, areas that might need actual infrastructure investment. This is where the community input is really important because you can kind of customize this to what you need for your region. What I have on the screen here is really kind of a starting point for discussion, an example. It's similar to what we've done with some of our other clients. So basically, we take that high injury network that Bryce described first, which is where most of the crashes have happened, and then we overlay it with the high-risk segments and the high-risk intersections. So we kind of overlay those networks together and we see where they overlap, and then they get higher priority then. And then we can factor in other things as well. So like, what is it near? Is it near schools, parks, transit? Do we want to put a priority associated with those types of land use? And then we can have an equity consideration too. Is this in a census tract that has a higher number of carless households or people over 65 or children or people with disabilities? So we can factor that in as well. We can also look at projects that the local jurisdictions are already planning. So if there's something in the CIP, we can say, hey, they already know that maybe a road just needs to be resurfaced, but now you can look at that project and say, well, when we do this, we can add in some safety improvements as well. And then the public survey comments, so we had all those points, and so we could look at where that also overlays to kind of bring things to the top. So this is, like I said, here a draft for us to talk more about as we go through the rest of the process. We're going to have some meetings with each of the communities so we can kind of talk through the priorities. And that's kind of what's on this slide. The next steps for data analysis: determine those factors and weights. Vet that with each of the communities, and then we can start to identify projects on that high priority network. So I also wanted to talk a little bit about the equity considerations. As you saw, equity was in that HPN criteria. So the SS4A does require that we consider underserved communities, which they define as areas of persistent poverty, and this is per the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act definition. And so in our case, this applies to any census tract that has a poverty rate of at least 20%. The way it's written into the law is that is using data from 2014 to 2018 from the American Community Survey. And then we need to look at how that our proposed projects and strategies impact those areas. The SS4A program gives us this tool, online tool, where you can see where those areas of persistent poverty are, and this is what comes up using that tool. We recognize, though, that this is a little bit disproportionate because of the student population and how that compares to longer-term low-income residents. So a large percentage of the population within the areas of persistent poverty are enrolled in college. I should point out, though, that the way that metric works, it does not count students that are living in dorms, but it would count students that are living in apartments or homes. but it is excluding dormitories. So we wanted to look at this with more current data, since that was, you know, 2018, and it's 2026 now. The most recent data we had was the 2023 American Community Survey data, so we looked at that instead. So you can see those shaded areas are a little bit different, but we do have a lot of overlap, particularly in the downtown area and around the university there. Now I'm going to move on to strategies. So once we have the, you know, the high priority network and areas that we want to do projects, how do we decide what we should do? So this is where the strategies come into play. So we have major projects. This would be like major reconstruction. We have systemic projects. So this is more lower cost countermeasures that you can put into play, usually through some type of policy. Like if you want to say we're always going to use high visibility crosswalks, maybe you want to use them everywhere that there's crosswalk. Maybe you want to use them in your downtown or near on safe routes to school. So that's kind of a systemic project. And policy strategies related to behavior modification, education, and best practices. And we are using the safe system approach, which is the Federal Highways guiding paradigm for traffic safety. And so we have the inner ring and the outer ring there, where we have the elements, safer people, safer vehicles, safer speed, safer roads, and post-crash care. When we talk about the Comprehensive Safety Action Plan, a lot of our focus ends up on safer speeds and safer roads, because that's the infrastructure part of things. We do also get into safer people. That's the behavior and enforcement side of things. And post-crash care is also important and something that we should talk about to be sure that, you know, all parts of the system are working together. We don't get into the safer vehicles quite as much, but we can certainly make support for safer vehicle designs as part of this study. And then the principles on the outside, death and serious injury are unacceptable. We accept that humans make mistakes. Humans are vulnerable. Responsibility is shared throughout all levels of, you know, from the public, the users of the system, to the governments that are operating and designing that transportation system. Safety is proactive. That's why we do the high-risk networks. We're looking at where crashes are likely to occur, not just where they have occurred. And redundancy is crucial. So if one part of the system fails, there's another part of the system that will prevent that death or serious injury. So now when we start to think about strategies, we want to look at what are the characteristics of the crashes that we can try to improve the situation so that we don't have those crashes occurring anymore. So this is all fatal and serious injury crashes and the characteristics of those crashes. So you can see the month of August is the highest, you know, from nighttime to early morning. Typically male drivers, if the driver is impaired, it's more likely to be fatal or serious injury than if they're not. They're often involving non-motorists. Single vehicle crashes are very common, and broadside crashes. The top five known major causes, failure to yield right of way, speeding, reckless driving, following too close, and running a traffic signal. So these are for all crashes, as I mentioned, but as you see in the red at the top there, non-motorists were only in 3% of all crashes, but 37% of fatal and serious injury crashes. So we do want to have some, you know, significant attention addressing the non-motorist fatal and serious injury crashes. So we pulled some data for those crashes in particular. Now, in this case, I do want to point out that we pulled a longer time period of crashes from another data source. So in order to get, you know, because there's only a small number of these crashes, even though they're the most overrepresented, we looked at 10 years of crash data from 2016 to 2025, whereas our other data is only 5 years. This is 10 years. So I pulled this from Iowa DOT's ICAT system. And so this is only non-motorist fatal and serious injury crashes. So we see some similarities. We still have, we have September instead of August, but honestly, August, September, and October are all pretty high. The late afternoon, evening hours, again, male drivers, younger drivers. The non-motorists were a mix of that 21 to 24-year-old range, which is likely your university population rate, but also the 45 to 49 non-motorist age. Pedestrians are more likely than cyclists, but there are more pedestrians, so that makes some sense. There's that 25-mile-per-hour road. And then influence of drugs or alcohol, only about 1.9% of the motorists were under the influence, and about 8.6% of the non-motorists in these cases. Driver contributing circumstances, driving too fast, failing to yield to a non-motorist, and failing to yield on a turn. And the non-motorists, what were they doing? Improper crossing, failure to obey, or not visible. I should point out, though, that in both cases of the driver and the non-motorist, most of the time, no one's doing anything wrong. So about 39% of the time, the driver did no improper action, and about 35% of the time, the non-motorist did improper action. So sometimes, you know, you can't always blame the behavior. I wanted to put this slide in here, too, because we've talked about intersections off and on, and as you can see, when you look at the location of where a fatal or serious injury crash has happened for a non-motorist, the vast majority of the time it's in an intersection. So we have the light blue intersections and the dark blue mid-block crossings. So similar circumstances are impacting a lot of these types of crashes. So strategy-wise, what do we do about that? The Federal Highway Administration has proven safety countermeasures, particularly for non-motorists, and this really focuses on either improving visibility or separating the non-motorist in space or separating the non-motorist in time. So separation in space is when you have that dedicated space. You have a dedicated bike lane, the pedestrian refuge, road diets that provide bike lanes and sidewalks, walkways, all of that sort of thing. Improving visibility would be the crosswalk enhancements. Rectangular rapid flashing beacons are improving visibility. And then separating in time would be the pedestrian hybrid beacons, because then you have a dedicated time to cross, and leading pedestrian intervals, which allow the pedestrian to enter the intersection before the motorist. So those are some of the proven safety countermeasures. But we also have speed to consider, because remember, speeding was part of the contributing causes as well. The proven safety countermeasures from FHWA really only address setting the speed limit and speed safety cameras for enforcement. Where this starts to kind of fall short is they don't really address the design of the road to encourage more proper appropriate speed. And that kind of brings us to the next part of planning and policy, and what are the communities doing to kind of go beyond just setting the right speed limit or enforcement of that speed limit, using complete street policies to make sure we have all those spaces on the road for everyone, doing your active transportation planning to plan that network. And we put street design standards other than SUDOPS, not intending to mean that SUDOPS is bad, but to look at additional guidance from AASHTO or NACTO that might go beyond what SUDOPS does right now. So when you start to get into some of the AASHTO design guides and the NACTO design guides, we can start to see some of those other tools that can be used to slow traffic to more appropriate speeds. So we have here also speed management issues, so traffic calming, narrower travel lanes, tighter turning radii. Those are the types of things that can help, you know, through design, have those motorists travel at a slower speed, in addition to some of the other things, speed feedback signs and that sort of thing are good as well. And as you can see, like, 20 is plenty. The 20 in the heart there is sort of a movement that indicates that 20 is fast enough in areas where there are a lot of people walking or biking in those shared spaces like you have in downtown Iowa City as well. There is enforcement as well, and increased police patrol, mobile speed radar units are important too. And high visibility is a type of enforcement where you go, where the police go to high crash locations. Saturation patrol is used to deter more during special events or holidays, that sort of thing. And integrated enforcement is really when you're pulling over for one reason and maybe issuing citations for multiple reasons. The example there on the right is from the city of Des Moines. They did a crosswalk safety enforcement project, and basically during that time, in about 2 hours, they issued 28 citations for 22 vehicles that failed to yield to pedestrians. So kind of doing that type of high vis for protecting vulnerable users, and then getting the media news out about it is part of that, not just enforcement, but also education. And speaking of education, there's less enforcement-based methods for that. So this is a great example I like to use from Missouri, and this was done with the help of the Missouri Department of Transportation, but really started by the city of Springfield. And it is just called Safe Across, and again, talking about crossing. As we noticed in the data, most of those crashes and concerns are at intersections or crossing the street for vulnerable road users. And this program that they did through education, a lot of targeting around schools and children, they did see driver compliance increase from 25 to 50%. So that's a pretty significant increase. And to wrap us up schedule-wise, so we are just ending March here. We are going to have another safety committee meeting coming up in April, and we're going to do an online open house. We'll also have a few more pop-up engagement booths, mostly in May and maybe May and June, and then have those stakeholder meetings with the cities when we're talking about that high-priority network and how to nail that down so that we can do our draft plan, which has to be submitted in July. So again, here's our next steps over the next 3 months. Having our safety committee meeting and online open house in April, engagement booth, and some city and stakeholder meetings in May and June. And with that, if there are any questions, Bryce and I can try to answer them.
Any questions? Thanks, Mindy. Thanks, Bryce. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Did your alarm go off at 11, your testing thing?
Yeah, it did. I don't think you could hear it, but that's okay.
We couldn't hear over here, so.
That's okay. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Bye-bye.
So, may have been helpful for me to mention this before Mindy started, but you all remember that all of the urban area communities helped fund this, right? So we had a $300,000 federal grant with a 20% local match. So all the urban communities funded this. We know all your communities are doing this type of work already. You all, I think, know that the MPO is doing some of this work already, but obviously the work that HDR is doing is a lot more in-depth and comprehensive than anything we've ever done. So the idea when this is all said and done, of course, is to have that high priority network, have our hotspots, and try and go in and actually correct some of those issues with a lot of the countermeasures that Mindy talked about. And again, because we do some of this work, I think we have a handle on it, but at the same time, I think it'll be immensely useful to us just to go into some of those spots that we're unaware of. And then, of course, they're going to give us some countermeasures that I think we might struggle with, at least a little bit locally, or not have a lot of experience with. So all that said, more exciting stuff to come. And Mindy had mentioned you guys all hear from Mindy one more time, I think, before the project's done later this fall, for the most part. Any questions? Okay, moving on to the next agenda item, number 4, consider a recommendation to the Urbanized Area Policy Board regarding locally determined projects for the MPO FY27 Transportation Planning Work Program. I had mentioned to you all at our last meeting that each spring we compile a list of Transportation Planning Work Program projects for the upcoming fiscal year. And while the exercise is required by our federal partners, we also utilize it to figure out what we're going to do in terms of our time and space and resources for you all. The attachment in your packet shows the projects we've received from either you or your staffs thus far. And I always mentioned to you all that this, you know, the list represents a fraction of the work we're actually going to do next year. But the more we can get you all to give us your projects early, that helps us get our data collection done, and of course helps us plan for the resources that we need to use. So What I'd like to ask of you today is that you please review the list of those projects if you've not already done so, and let me know of any additions or clarifications. I don't think I would understand what they're saying, even if I didn't know it was a weather drill. So getting back to this, what I'm hopeful that you can do is look at that list and, you know, let me know of any additions or clarifications. And then we'll be bringing this back to you along with the entire work program, which will include ongoing projects that we're already working on or hadn't completed last year, if you will, at your next meeting. So that said, if there are any additions or clarifications, please speak up. Otherwise, looking for a motion to approve and send this on to the board next week for their approval as well.
So moved.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you very much. And again, you'll have a chance at the next meeting to have a look at this quick as well and let us know of anything that pops into your minds. Thank you. Moving on to agenda item number 5, consider recommendation to the Urbanized Area Policy Board regarding approval of the MPO FY27-31 Passenger Transportation Plan. Hannah.
Good morning, Hannah Neal, Associate Transportation Planner. Today we are asking for a recommendation to the Policy Board regarding the approval of the MPOJC FY27-31 PTP, or Passenger Transportation Plan. The PTP is required by the DOT and is intended to coordinate planning for transit-related funding programs. It incorporates federal requirements for coordinated planning, as well as addresses needs-based project justification, and it serves as a tool to help meet specific passenger transportation needs, and it's also required to be identified in our transportation planning work program, which Kent just talked about. MPOJC is required to adopt a new PTP every 5 years, and again, this one covers FY27-31. And in the years between the required updates, we provide the DOT with agendas and minutes from the Johnson County Seats Paratransit Advisory Committee and also from the Johnson County Mobility Coordinator Advisory Committee. These committees, along with the Johnson County Livable Communities for Successful Aging, have connections with local human services and transit agencies, and members of these committees reviewed and provided input to update the PTP. The committees reviewed the status of past priorities and recent developments and developed a list of service, fleet, and facility needs, priorities for the next 5 years and beyond, and goals and objectives for the FY27-31 plan. In these meetings, past priorities, updates on the last 5 years, recent developments, and anticipated needs, goals and objectives for the next 5 years have all been established. The update was sent to the PTP committee, including transit managers and Iowa DOT for comment, and the public comment period for this document is currently underway. It will wrap up next week. If you have comments, please reach out to me. Based on discussions with the committee members, late night and weekend services for both fixed route and paratransit, facilities and technology, training and education, and regional service options remain the top priorities. More specifically, service to healthcare and service to North Liberty, as well as having comprehensive information at bus stops and having more bus stops were top discussion points. Federal FTA 5310, or Enhanced Mobility of Seniors and Individuals with Disabilities, those funds are also discussed in the PTP, and historically these funds have been used for ADA support. Iowa City Transit and Coralville Transit use these for their seats contract, and then CAN Bus uses theirs for paratransit operations as well. A few other things to note. Iowa City Transit is still working to get their new transit facility up and running. North Liberty service is going to cease on June 30th due to low ridership and funding. Coralville will no longer be providing service in North Liberty because they are terminating the contract. MPO has been also asked to assist with efforts to help figure out next steps for North Liberty Service. Some of those discussions are already happening, mostly with seats, as far as I know. And those are ongoing discussions. So all of this being said, today we are asking for a recommendation to the policy board for the approval of this PTP. If you have any questions, feel free to ask, or transit managers, please chime in.
And I do have some late-breaking comments. I apologize. I was out of the office. They're not substantive to everybody in the group. I'd say it's specific to Iowa City Transit. So, but outside of that, I thought, I reviewed the document, and I thought everything was aligned. Just a few comments from Iowa City Transit's perspective on our operations.
Great. Would you want to email those to me, or do you want to discuss this
now? I can give you a hard copy.
Perfect. Anybody else?
And the PTP itself wasn't included. It's something like 200 pages long when you add up all the different schedules of the three different agencies and the public comment. But suffice it to say, it's available with the link there in your memo.
Yes.
Any questions or comments? Aside from Darian's addition, motion to approve?
So moved.
Motion is there a second? Motion and a second. Any further discussion? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. And we will include the comments, Darian, as they move on to the board. Moving on to agenda item number six, an update regarding the MPO FY27 transit program of projects.
Great. Still me. So this is just an informational update. I'm not asking for a recommendation to the policy board. So Coralville, Iowa City, and CAN-BUS are all programming projects for their FTA FY27 funds. These will be included in the DOT FY27 consolidated transit funding application that MPOJC completes for each transit system. And these are projects that are also going to be included in our FY27 to 30 Transportation Improvement Program, RTIP. Not every project listed in the program of projects will be funded. However, to be eligible for federal funding, these projects must be included in the program of projects, and the program of projects is tied directly to our TIP. Projects included, and they should be in your packets as well if you'd like to review. Projects included are buses, equipment, facility funding, operations, 5310, and other transit-related items. This information will be included, again, in the draft 27 to 30 TIP, and this will also be presented to you at your May meeting. All three transit agencies will hold public hearings and have their program of projects approved as part of the consolidated funding application process, and the CFAs are due May 1st, so we'll be coming back to you with these things pretty soon. Transit managers, if there's anything that you want to chime in on, specific projects or anything like that. Otherwise, this is just a general update.
Any questions or comments? Thanks, Hannah. Moving on to agenda item number seven, update on the MPO long-range transportation plan revision process. Madeline.
Good morning, Madeline Stone, Associate Transportation Planner. Just wanted to provide an update on our process for our long-range transportation plan. As a reminder, like we've been discussing for the past year, the long-range transportation plan is a federally required U.S. Department of Transportation document to for all urbanized areas in order to receive federal funding. The plan must be reevaluated and updated every 5 years, and it addresses transportation issues across the urbanized area. In January, the Urbanized Area Policy Board approved the vision, guiding principles, and scoring criteria for the LRTP, which you all recommended for approval in November. Since your last meeting, the MPO staff have been scoring transportation infrastructure projects that each of your communities have provided to us, and gathering performance measure data and establishing public input opportunities. And here are a few of the public engagement opportunities that we have been doing and will be continuing to do this spring. We will be releasing a general survey this week for all of those who live, work, and attend school in Johnson County. And the general survey is designed to just better understand how residents are getting from place to place and anything and any changes that are recommended from residents to make transportation easier or safer throughout the metro area. In April, we will also be releasing a trail survey, and this will be an online survey for those who use the trail system to better understand how they use the trail system and to understand their experiences on the trail. This survey will be open until May, and we will be advertising this through signs that will be within the trail network. We will also be releasing a photo voice survey, and this survey is a little bit unique, and it's more designed for to specifically reach out to residents who have troubles with transportation, and especially where driving isn't an option. So we are working with the county and the university to advertise that survey. And it's essentially a normal survey, but with more qualitative opportunities through pictures and descriptions of what their experiences are through the intersection. Staff has also reached out to interested parties and organizations within Johnson County to give a presentation on the long-range transportation plan. And in the past month, we have presented to Greater Iowa City and the Downtown Noon Rotary Club to advertise public engagement and just provide and receive preliminary feedback. And we will also be releasing a student survey that will go out to the middle schools and high schools. And I had just gotten word that that City High will be taking this survey. And that's just to better understand students and their experiences with transportation and what might help with their transportation needs as people who might not have access to vehicles. And then for our plan for the rest of the spring, we will be in for our next meeting. Our plan is to present sections of the long-range plan for your review. And I am happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Madeline about the process or where we're at? I've mentioned this at a few meetings. The long-range plan is a heavy lift for us. You know, it's like an 18-month process. All the work we do for your agencies doesn't stop. This is just something in addition we do. And as Madeline mentioned, we've been super busy with it. So in the next probably two or three meetings we will have started to draft materials, and we'll be starting to bring those to you for your approvals and your recommendations to the board. So you can expect that over the next two or three meetings, four meetings. Maybe five. We'll see how it goes. Thanks, Madeline. Moving on to agenda item number 8, other business. Maybe we'll take 10 or 15 minutes to go around the room for some quick updates. Brock, you want to start?
Sure. Well, ECOG is also doing a Safe Streets for All plan process. Not near as far along as MPO, but again, that covers the rural area of Johnson County and five other counties. And also a passenger transportation plan that and identified, so a lot of the same issues and kind of strategies in both those plans. It's good to see there's some overlap.
Definitely.
Our North Park Road project is closed again, just north of the two elementary schools. It's the last section needs to be widened to four lanes. That'll go another 4 months, probably, and that will be wrapped up. Our Highway 6 expansion project, from Main Street to the roundabout on Park Road, is set to go to the DOT in May for a 90% review. We did that in October, and then this time next year, I'll start that widening to three lanes, which basically completed all the way through to the.
I'll let Scott cover the IOC questions.
Great.
I don't think we have anything
to come up with.
Okay. Save the round.
I know. Seems like old news. It should get started here, like you said, this time this month.
That'd be good. Moving ahead slowly with the Melrose reconstruction in the area of Melrose, Gulfview, Poser. Should start to see some undergrounding of utilities coming up, boring for that. Trail system, they've started to plot a new multi-use trail system, what we call this Fisher Track, the wooded ravine on the north side. And this spring we're doing a sidewalk rehab for pedestrians throughout the whole town. We also have an RRFB going up on Sunset to help mostly the elementary school kids crossing to and from the elementary school, but also for pedestrian commuters.
Just going to give a quick update on our Court Street project. We're started work on construction for year two, which is from 7th to 2nd Avenue. And then we're also working on finishing up the work from last year, which is mainly sidewalks and some retaining walls and some driveways. So hopefully this year goes a little bit smoother. Last year was a bit of a struggle with some utility relocations, but hopefully we can make up some ground and finish up the project next year with work at the 1st Avenue intersection. So,
yeah. Run. Scott?
This past week ago Monday, we started the last phase of our 5th Street improvements. So 5th Street is closed right adjacent to the Corville Public Library, and we would expect that to remain closed until mid-June. So, of course, yesterday we discovered an ancient 3x5 box culvert that none of our previous maps showed anything. So, another change order.
Yeah.
No surprise. Yeah. So, that's underway. And then tonight we hope to award or planning to award the contract for the Heartland Drive Commerce Drive roundabout, which again is at the southerly driveway at Costco. And then we've been doing tree felling related to Forever Green Road Extension Phase 1 to beat the Indiana Bat habitat period. So, and then I'll mention, I think many of you know, but Deputy City Administrator Ellen Hovel is leaving the city at the end of this month, and she's going to be the Executive Director at EC Icon. So, she'll still be around.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That's great.
All right. So I think I shared at our last meeting that we've been hot and cold with the federal government over our $23 million grant for a new transit facility and 4 electric buses. And, of course, the federal government asked us to ask them to change the propulsion type of the buses that were coupled with that project. They were electric buses. So we did ask them formally to change from electric to hybrid diesel. And then we've been waiting for months and months and months and months, kind of in limbo. And we did just get word 2 weeks ago now, I think it has been, for the third time that we received the grant. And we got it in writing. It is not yet obligated, so I will sleep better at night in a couple of weeks when we can get to that point. But that's been a whole ordeal for the last year, so we're happy to get some movement on that. Other good news is that we, as of yesterday or as of today, we submitted a purchase order for 11 heavy-duty diesel buses. We're in desperate need of buses at this time, and so we were able to get that in prior to the end of the month, which was a big deadline for us. And thank you very much, Hannah, and the help of the MPO to get that rush order in. We are also continuing with design with the joint transit facility and maintenance equipment facility. It'll be, Ron's department will be co-located at the same location, so we're happy to keep moving that project along. We're approaching 30% design. We're hoping to have NEPA sign off within the next week or two, again, to get to the obligation, get signed agreement with the Federal Transit Administration. So, and Dawn's gone. She would have cheered for this too, but we also submitted a purchase order last month for a new paratransit vehicles as well, and we have 2 that should be coming any day now, so that'll be 10 new vehicles for our paratransit, 10 out of 14 new vehicles for our paratransit services, which will be cheered both from the seats side things operationally, but also from our maintenance team. They're going to be really excited to get those in, so good news with us, Lee.
Dawn was excited. She mentioned the buses to me before the meeting.
Okay.
Yeah. She is excited.
So from the university side, last November we were selected for a LONO grant to get 6 hybrid buses to replace 6 diesel buses that are 2008-2009 models. Just received confirmation from the FTA a couple weeks ago we can move forward with that purchase, so we started that conversation with Gillig to get those 6 buses on order. It's looking like an 18-month lead time on getting those, so we're hoping to see those by the end of 2027. And then similar boat as Iowa City, our facility and bus grant has been tied up at the federal level, we're at 100% design from the university's perspective. We're ready to bid this thing as soon as FDA says, you know, here's a signed contract. We also had to request to change our buses in that project from battery electric into hybrid, and so we just got confirmation also a couple of years ago. We are approved to move forward with our project so long as we change it to a hybrid bus project, which we expected. So we have a meeting with our FDA regents and reps tomorrow to figure out where do things stand, what updates do you need from us so that we can move forward with that grant obligation and get this project bid. So that's it for us.
I would just note that we actually received two new light duty buses about 2 weeks ago, so we're in the make ready process of getting those ready to put in our air transit.
Well, Darian laid a lot out there. She forgot, though, we've got we're evaluating proposals right now for a bus stop kind of improvement plan. So they'll be doing full inventory of our bus stops and essentially give us a schedule of what we should do, what we could do to improve bus stops, ADA, shelters, a number of different things. So we're evaluating those proposals right now to get that awarded soon and start that process. So that'll be another big project that we'll be working on this summer.
That's great. Anything else from the rest of the group? Good. Okay, thank you everyone for attending. I really appreciate it. It's good to see everyone. Looking for a motion to adjourn. So moved. A second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much.